This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind chamber where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, what does living with COVID actually mean? COVID is not going away. It's going to be with us for many, many years, perhaps forever, and we have to learn to live with it, said the Health Secretary Sajid Javid last week. So what does learning to live with COVID actually mean? And have we almost reached that point? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. But first, how has our understanding of COVID's newest variant, Omicron, evolved since Plan B restrictions were first imposed 7 weeks ago? Azra Ghani is Professor of Infectious Disease Epidemiology at Imperial College London. Azra Ghani, what are the latest infection numbers?
We're seeing, of course, a rapid decline since the beginning of January. So we're now hovering under the 100,000 per day reported cases. It seems to have plateaued a little bit in recent days. But what that is masking is quite a variable pattern in different age groups. The major place where we've seen the increase is in children, that's both primary age and secondary school age. And that is not, of course, that surprising because transmission in that group will have been interrupted over the Christmas holidays and has started up again now that there is more mixing back at school. In the older adult groups overall, we've seen declines, but we are concerned that there may be some increase now as transmission goes within households and within families, from the school children that are becoming infected onto, of course, their parents. And that may give rise to increases in other age groups in the coming days.
Young children are the group who are least likely to get seriously ill, aren't they?
We've seen a very slight hint of an increased rate of hospitalisation in the under five age group, but those appear to be mild infections, not anything of serious concern. And the overall rates, of course, remain very low in terms of serious outcomes in children.
Back in December, it looked like it was just very transmissible, significantly more than Delta. That was the assumption. Now we've had more time to live with it. What can we say about the transmissibility of Omicron?
Well, it's actually a very complex picture, so I'll try to sort of disentangle some of the different elements here. We first, of course, saw that Omicron has replaced Delta very quickly, so within a month. And we saw, of course, associated with that, a very rapid increase in cases in the UK peaking in early January. But there's a number of factors that underlie that that could give rise to that particular pattern. The first is what we're generally in scientific circles calling something called immune escape. And what that means is that the Omicron variant is able to infect people who've previously been infected with the Delta variant, but also more likely to infect people with vaccines. And in particular, we've seen a loss of the efficacy of the vaccines against mild disease if there have only been two doses of that vaccine. And it is still able to infect people even if they've had their booster doses, although at a lower rate. And so what that can give rise to is this very apparent increase in transmissibility. But what is difficult to say is whether intrinsically the virus is more transmissible or it is just appearing more transmissible because it's able to overcome that wall of immune protection that we've developed.
We made the assumption that Omicron had evolved in order to be more transmissible. What you're saying is that Omicron has evolved to be able to deal with the vaccine.
Yes, and it may still have evolved to be a little bit more transmissible, but perhaps not as much as we originally feared. And that has important implications for how high the peak would be. And we've seen, of course, we've probably hopefully passed the initial peak. So it does have implications for what we expect to see in terms of patterns of infection in the future.
Does it present in any way differently? In other words, is there anything different about what you get if you've got Omicron to what you get if you had Delta?
It does appear to present quite differently. The major functional aspect of it is that it appears to stay in what we call the upper respiratory tract around the nose and throat and not get so deeply into the lungs. And that may be part of the reason what we're then seeing is generally milder symptoms, some hint of slightly more asymptomatic infection.
Is it any easier for a virus that exists more in the upper respiratory tract to be transmitted than it is for a virus in the lower respiratory tract? Or is it about the same?
I think we'd hypothesise that it should be easier. It's in the areas which are going to come into more contact. But what we're also seeing is a reduction in the amount of virus people have. So what we call the viral load seems to be a little bit reduced compared to the Delta virus. So all these things balance together to give us the overall pattern of this new variant.
Is it intrinsically milder in itself, in its effect upon people? Or is it milder because the various other things that we do at the moment, like vaccination, mitigate its effects so much?
It is a combination of the two, but we do expect that it is actually intrinsically milder. And we can see that in the number of people who have developed infection reported as cases in the unvaccinated and also in those that haven't previously had a recorded past infection. And it does appear to be up to maybe 50% milder or less likely to result, for example, in hospitalisation. And that may be partly due to the fact it's not getting into the lungs and it's not therefore generating a wider problematic infection across the body. But on top of that, of course, we also have the much greater immunity in the population, both through past exposure and with the vaccines.
Azra, this may seem like a peculiar final question, but from what you've been saying, it strikes me that we may have been rather lucky that the latest big variant we got was Omicron with these properties.
It does feel like, to those of us who were looking at this in early December when we didn't know these properties of the virus and were really getting quite concerned at the rate with which it was spreading, it does seem to us that we have been quite lucky in this particular variant. But we're left with a very uncertain future. We know that these variants can emerge and spread rapidly. It's very difficult to say what they might look like.
Azra Ghani, now we've understood how the dominant variant behaves towards us, let's turn to its effect on our health system and hospitals, always regarded as the critical element in deciding how the pandemic should be handled. So what sort of pressure have they been under, and what might that tell us about what's needed for them to cope in the future as we learn to live with COVID? To discuss that are Saffron Caudray, Deputy Chief Executive of NHS Providers, and Leslie Powles, Head of Clinical Site and Emergency Planning at King's College Hospital in London. Leslie Powles, I want to find out a bit more about how hospitals plan for this latest surge. Now, compared to previous waves, how quickly was King's able to prepare for Omicron when it hit in December?
So we'd been preparing, actually, ever since we came out of the end of wave two. So our preparation was very easy, but the speed at which we had to put all of our plans into place was incredibly fast, whereas this time it felt like it happened almost overnight.
And where did the pressures emerge?
So much, much smaller numbers into intensive care. The majority of our patients were coming in either through A&E as COVID admissions, i.e. COVID was the thing that was bringing them to hospital, or they were coming in for other reasons. And on testing, we discovered that they had COVID. So it was much more in the general bed-based population rather than critical care.
And how long on average were people staying in wards?
So yeah, much shorter this time round. So kind of 4 to 5 days was the average stay, whereas previously that had been closer to a week. And in surge one, actually much longer than that.
So did that mean that your modelling had been based on probably having more people into ICU and you had to quite rapidly change the way in which you were thinking about it?
Yeah, we've got some really clever guys at King's in our business intelligence unit who do daily modelling for us. So every morning we receive a kind of what you can expect to happen today for COVID. So it was very easy for us to plan what we needed on a daily basis. and our existing plan was based roughly on about the right numbers.
In other words, these brilliant modellers of yours actually essentially got it right.
Yeah, they did. And they got it right in wave two as well. They're very, very clever.
OK, Saffron Cordery, across the country, were there fewer COVID admissions for Omicron than in previous waves?
Absolutely they were, but it was a varied picture. So in different regions, we saw higher percentages. So, for example, in the northeast and the northwest, broadly, the levels of Omicron have been around 75% of the previous wave. It's much lower in London, much lower in the southeast, southwest, and the east of England. And I think the other thing to remember there is that it came to different parts of the country at different times. So when we talk about that wave now coming to an end for Omicron in London, that's definitely the case. But I think if you go to the northwest, lots of hospitals would tell you that they're pretty much still struggling through that. And so it's hit them later.
Now, let's talk about certain treatments which have come online since the beginning of the pandemic for people who have got COVID. What impact have they had, Saffron?
With more advanced treatments, such as steroid treatments, for example, we can both nip COVID in the bud and also shorten the length of time that people might need to stay in hospital. And the other thing I would add into that, which probably accounts for some of the lower levels of hospitalizations that we are seeing with this wave, is the fact that we've got significant numbers of people now vaccinated.
Leslie, let's turn now to the other side of this. We talked about patients. Now let's talk about staff absences. How many staff did you have off as a result of COVID, either ill or isolating, in your worst week during the latest surge? And how does that compare to where you are now?
Our worst week, which was the week of Christmas, we had 720 staff off sick with COVID. That was from about a group of 14,000 staff. But of course, there were other staff sicknesses on top of that. Now, comparing that to today, we've got 226 staff off sick with COVID. So it was a significant proportion of our workforce. It's roughly 7% of the workforce off sick at one time.
And now it's 2%. And is 2% more than average before COVID, or is it about the same?
So this is probably on par with what we'd normally see with kind of seasonal colds and flus within our staffing group.
So in other words, currently in King's, there is not a COVID-related substantial problem of staff absence?
At the moment, no. It's not causing a significant impact on our daily business at all.
Saffron Cordery, what is the impact more generally of staff absences on the NHS currently?
Well, we are seeing high levels of staff absences across the country. That speaks to the fact that, you know, obviously Leslie's experience in London is that they are now through that or getting through that surge, whereas in the rest of the country, that isn't necessarily the case. In terms of staff absences across the country, around 46% of them actually relate to COVID absences. And what that means, it makes it incredibly hard to actually fill shifts, fill rotas. I think the other thing we have to factor in here is staffing challenges in social care, which actually mean that hospitals are unable to discharge patients. So that's an added factor, but it's not an insignificant factor.
Not insignificant at all. Let's push forward a bit. Saffron, can we look at what living with COVID means for hospitals? Wider society will get rid of some of the mitigations that it's got in place at the moment, some of the distancing, masks, etc. Will hospitals continue with them, or will hospitals get rid of them too?
I think we're very likely to see hospitals maintaining pretty high levels of infection control and infection prevention, because what we don't want to see is a situation where within hospitals we are seeing COVID being spread. It's really important that hospital doesn't become the place that people contract COVID in the future. I also think we're likely to see some of the more structural changes remain in place. So lots of hospital trusts have moved to having kind of hot and cold sites, where one site will deal broadly with routine operations for people not infected with COVID. I think that we're likely to see that separation even as we continue with lower levels of COVID in the community.
Leslie Powers, your workforce also has to go out of the workplace and into wider society. If you have the mitigations in place in King's, what are you going to do to try and make sure that some of them are in place for the same staff outside the hospital and NHS environment?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because clearly you could not wear a mask coming into work and then be asked to wear one as soon as you arrive at work. I mean, clearly we can't mandate our staff to behave in any way outside of the workplace, but certainly some of our messaging throughout this last surge has been about the fact that, yes, you can socialise, but we would ask you to make sure that you are undertaking regular testing, that you remain distanced where possible.
And you think that will continue?
I think it will, yes.
Saffron, if self-isolation ends for everybody else, would you want to see it end for the NHS more generally? I suppose the point that I'm really getting at here is whether or not we can expect continued high levels of staff absence as people self-isolate, or whether you won't be demanding that level of self-isolation in general, partially in order not to have the absences.
You know, we will need to see the rules change as we go forward, because staffing levels will not cope with people being off on an ongoing basis. But it's important that individual organisations, individual trusts are able to do what is entirely appropriate for their setting. It will be a differentiated approach. Obviously, if someone isn't in a frontline role and they're not coming into contact with patients, then they don't need such rigorous isolation rules. Every setting will have its particular set of constraints and circumstances that will require a flex, really, so that it's the safest possible environment for patients.
That was Saffron Cordery with Leslie Powles. Time to put that all together and then throw it forward so we can ask what it's reasonable to expect in the near future and how to plan for it. Linda Bold is a behavioural scientist and professor of public health at Edinburgh University, and Emma Thompson is professor in infectious diseases at the University of Glasgow's Centre for Virus Research. Linda Bold, let's get some definitions straight right from the beginning. What does endemic actually mean?
Well, this is a term which I think is being widely used at the moment. It's an infection, and it's one in which the overall rates are static. So they're not rising, they're not falling. We have a number of endemic viruses. We live alongside rhinoviruses, for example, malaria, even polio. The virus can still be widespread. It can still cause health harms, but it's existing in a population often at levels which have a predictability about it.
So the key to the word endemic is predictability.
That's an element of it, or rates are static, so they're not necessarily rising or falling. You might have outbreaks. Let's use the example of measles, where because of a drop-off in vaccination, we have had outbreaks recently in children around the world. But you know a lot about the virus, and there is an element of predictability, yes.
Okay, but would you describe something as endemic or not endemic on account partially of its severity? Has that got nothing to do with it?
It's not the key component of it, because things can become quite severe. With malaria, for example, we know that that recently killed over 600,000 people in 1 year, tuberculosis over 1.5 million people in recent years annually. So you can still have really severe outcomes, but it's more that we're used to dealing with those diseases. We know a lot about them.
Okay, so we're not at the stage whereby we can describe COVID as endemic. Are we getting to the place where we can describe it as, like, say, flu, as being seasonal?
Definitely the answer to that is no at the moment. I think there are conditions in the cold months that make transmission and the direct risk to us higher. In other words, we tend to gather in more indoor places, ventilation is more of an issue, etc. So our behaviour may make things more challenging in the winter months, whether you're in the northern or the southern hemisphere. But we haven't seen a seasonal pattern with this virus, SARS-CoV-2. Now let's just look back and use some examples. We know we had Alpha, for example, in the autumn, Delta in the spring of last year. Those were new variants that appeared not in the winter months. So I think we shouldn't assume that we're going to have a seasonal pattern at the moment of SARS-CoV-2. That might be more the case in future, but that's not where we are now.
And that presumably is partially because it's global.
That's correct. And in fact, the biggest threat in thinking about how this becomes an endemic infection is the global situation. So because there are so many different places around the world in different situations, for example, we only have 5% of people in low-income countries fully vaccinated currently. That's a big contrast to more higher-income countries. So I think the global situation is a key component here.
Yeah, so that impacts upon possible seasonality because these variants can come at any season from anywhere. Emma Thompson, I'm wondering when we get to the point whereby we can make a comparison with flu and how we manage it.
We have to bear in mind that variants can occur from anywhere, and that's quite a lot less predictable than influenza, which we tend to be able to base vaccines, for example, on what's going on in Asia and other countries in their winter months. And that's not going to be so straightforward for SARS-CoV-2 at the moment because the variants are popping up in lots of different parts of the world. We don't quite know where the next one is coming from. What we do have, and what's been quite extraordinary, is this armamentarium of new vaccine methods. And so it is possible to develop vaccines more rapidly now, but it still takes time. They still have to be tested and approved. So we're going to have to be very speedy at reacting to new variants if they look dangerous.
Linda, do you think that there are additional lessons we could learn from flu management for forward management of COVID?
I think there are. I mean, the main lesson, and this is one that we've already learned, is surveillance. So we have a global surveillance system for looking at influenza. As Emma says, we're looking across countries, learning from them. We do that every year. We also report those data. There are multiple sources for those data, from the population, from people who need care in hospital, from primary care, etc. And actually, the UK Health Security Agency, one of its reporting mechanisms for COVID-19 now is alongside flu. So they have a briefing that they produce and they report on all the surveillance. So that is one of the most important things we can learn. And the second one, as Emma says, is adapting our approach to vaccines. So every time we offer an influenza vaccine, and let's remember we've had record numbers of people taking it up in the last few months in the UK compared to previous years, we have to change the vaccine regularly. And we also, importantly, don't offer it to everyone. We offer it to groups that are more vulnerable, which might be an approach we take with COVID-19 in the future.
Emma, from what we currently know about COVID, can we expect vaccines to keep up with the variants? And might that mean getting an annual vaccine?
Yes, I think an annual vaccine might be a realistic prospect, particularly for people who are in vulnerable groups.
Can I just ask you what might seem like a daft question? Why does the third booster dose give you so much more protection than two doses when you've already had them? It's not obvious.
When you have additional exposures to protein, which is effectively what's happening with the vaccine, your immune system increases its affinity for the virus. So it gets better and better. It gets more highly trained with each exposure. And although the Omicron variant is quite different from the Wuhan original variant, that seems to allow your immune system to get kind of super fit and able to control even a variant which is quite different.
That's fascinating. Linda Bolt, COVID is not epidemiologically endemic, but given what we now know about its severity and its interrelationship with the vaccine, is it reasonable for politicians to set policy as if it was endemic?
The long-term harms that we're causing to people's mental health, to, for example, life chances of young people, and to people's employment status, we know inequalities have widened. These are really, really serious issues. In my mind, they're as serious, actually, as dealing with and understanding this virus. So it's a tricky time, but while not everyone absolutely agrees with the decisions that different governments are making, you can also have sympathy for the different trade-offs they have to weigh up.
So with the end of self-isolation being flagged in England, at least maybe in March, you wouldn't see that as an unreasonable adjustment?
Well, what I've tried to distinguish from people who have commonly asked me about this is the approach. So at the moment in England, if you don't self-isolate, if you're advised by test and trace, you can be fined, quite a big fine. I think that punitive approach is not welcome. I would prefer that we continued absolutely with self-isolation. It's kind of step number one of basic public health when you've got an infectious virus. But we are moving to a situation where it needs to be advice and support for people, not saying, you know, we absolutely stipulate that everybody under all circumstances must isolate for this number of days. And if you don't, you're essentially breaking the law. I think we need to move away from that.
Now, can I ask you, if you like, the kind of the biggest question of all? I've heard it put several times that there is a kind of evolution, a natural way in which viruses evolve towards more transmissibility. And so say quite a lot of people towards less severity. Is that a likely direction of travel? Or is it just as possible that we could get a variant which is more severe? Emma Thompson.
We've seen shifts in both directions with the variants that we've already seen. So Delta was more severe than Alpha, and we know that it was associated with an increase in the likelihood of severe pathology, including pneumonia. And now we've seen a shift towards less pathology with Omicron. Now, I don't think that we can take for granted that the next variant will behave even less severely than Omicron. I think it's probably a fairly lazy assumption that to suggest that viruses tend to evolve towards being less virulent. The real balance for the SARS-CoV-2 virus at the moment is between transmissibility and evasion of the immune response. The effect on individuals who are affected with it is not something that the virus considers, if you like. And so if a virus is able to transmit readily, then the important second sort of consideration, I guess, is how well it spreads in a population that has varying levels of immunity. And so the balance early on in SARS-CoV-2's outbreak has been very much towards transmissibility. But now evasion of the immune response is really key. And so Omicron is by far the most immune evading variant that we've seen. And I think that we'll see more in that direction. But there is another fundamental change in the virus in that its biology is quite different. It's, if you like, it's entering cells in a completely different way. So if you like, it's using a different set of keys to get into cells. And we think that the way that the virus is entering cells may be affecting the severity of illness. It's less able to spread from cell to cell, and it's less well able to divide in lung cells and much more able to divide in nasal cells, so cells in your nose. We don't know yet how the next variant will get into cells, how it will behave biologically, and we don't know if the next variant is going to do the same thing. And I think these are very fundamental sort of issues that we need to explore very rapidly when we do see new variants emerge.
Well, a summary on that is that we could quite easily have a variant which is more severe.
Yes.
Linda Bold, if we summarise our position then, it would seem to be that it is not unreasonable to think that this phase of the pandemic might be ending, but that our policy has to be associated with continual vigilance and scientific research.
That's correct. I think we need to manage this virus. That's the shift we need to make. We've been trying to manage it, but we need to manage it while opening up things or keeping them open as appropriate to deal with the accumulated harms that I mentioned. I completely agree with Emma. There's no predictable kind of evolutionary outcomes for this virus. So we may have something that causes us more worry. So I think the three key components actually are: recognize that shutting lots of sectors again causes huge harm, so we need to avoid that. Maintain our public health response. That includes testing, in my view. Now, I know that's being debated. I know it's expensive, but we need access to testing, advice on self-isolation, support for individuals. And then thirdly, this active ongoing preparation for the next variant, the next set of outbreaks. So those are the three things, and that includes a longer term pandemic preparedness. And actually the fourth, as we've already discussed, is just taking a global perspective and vaccines in other countries and supporting intergovernmental organizations. So this is a complex network of things we have to do, but I think if we can do them effectively in concert, it means that actually we may be able to continue with our lives in a more normal way for the foreseeable future, while recognising that things may change and we'll have to take appropriate action if they do.
That was Linda Bold with Emma Thompson. My thanks to them and to Azra Ghani, Saffron Cordery and Leslie Powles. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. But if you want to hear about the problem of tackling the now enormous NHS waiting lists, a new three-part series, The Backlog, starts on February the 9th. You can find that, along with other episodes of The Briefing Room, such as How Variants Evolve, How Scared We Should Be of Inflation, and Why War is Threatened in Ukraine, on BBC Sounds.
Here we go, OT. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Dance. It has the power to connect.
and to entertain. And in a new series for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, I explore the iconic dancers who have been doing just that.
Dance, it really, I think, saved my life.
Join me, Oti Mabuse, as I delve into the lives of the innovators and the mold breakers who have changed dance forever.
Gene Kelly was this working class guy that I just really connected with that.
Oti Mabuse's Dancing Legends on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.